You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's episode, we journey to Canada in the company of our good friend W.T. Watson. In his new book, Canadian Monsters and Mysteries, Travis travels the length and breadth of the second largest country in the world on the search for all kinds of Fortean phenomena. We cover a whole range of strange incidents and encounters, from mer people, sea and lake monsters, incredible encounters with giant beavers, and even some dinosaurs. There's also giant wolves, strange tribes in the north, and two of the most compelling and confusing UFO cases in Canada's history. It's always a pleasure speaking with Mr. Watson. But as always, before we get there, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for Patreon. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, early releases, and bonus content. You can click on the link in the show notes, or go to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find the website, mysteriesandmonsters.com, for news, episodes, and merchandise. As always, a massive thank you to my brother, Dean Bestel, for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, to Canada we go, on the hunt for more monsters and mysteries than you can shake a Sasquatch at. Today, we head out and about the nation of Canada in the company of our good friend, W.T. Watson, in his fabulous new book, Canadian Monsters and Mysteries. Travis uncovers stories of strange creatures of land, air and water, phantoms and shadow people, and encounters with visitors from other worlds. In a country as large as Canada, it comes as no surprise to many to see that people are having all kinds of weird encounters. Travis, welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters.
Well, thanks for having me back, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you are very welcome, because I was very excited the last time we spoke when you hinted at your next publication as a lover of all weird things. And it's nice to always have someone of a similar mindset that seems to enjoy all the weird aspects of the Fortean. So I was really looking forward to this book when I heard what you were trying to cover and the subjects that basically nothing was off the table, really.
One of the things that, let me back up and give the origin story a little bit here. I moved to Canada in 2020. My partner got a position as an instructor at the University of Waterloo and is happily ensconced there now. And of course, you know, being who I am, as soon as I got up here, I started thinking to myself, well, gosh, I wonder what kind of weirdness, strangeness, Fortiana I can get into up here. And as with Mysteries and Myths, I went down the rabbit hole and started researching some of the odd occurrences in Canada and discovered that there's a whole batch of things that researchers and investigators south of the border in the States just don't seem to cover or cover superficially, I guess. So my goal in writing this book is to kind of give people who may not be familiar with Canadian strangeness, an introduction to some of the wild lore that happens up here. And in addition to give exposure to some of those stories that we were talking about before we went on the air that are really, really good cases, but don't get a lot of attention because they're in Canada. I sometimes theorize that people in the States think that once you cross the border into Canada, you've entered this icy realm of subarctic frozenness and nothing happens to it. And nothing could be farther from the truth. You know, Canada is the second largest country in the world. It has the longest coastline in the world. It has tons and tons of lakes. I don't remember the exact number, but it has tens of thousands of lakes throughout the country. many of which have descriptions of cryptid creatures in them.
Mm.
You know, there are all kinds of interesting stories that come up as soon as you start to research. What I had to do, though, was figure out the things that I wasn't going to include in the book. Obviously, there's a huge, huge realm of Sasquatch lore here in Canada, most of it in British Columbia. So I chose not to do that for this book because I'm plenty of other researchers who are working in that field. As far as lake monsters go, I stay with the lakes that are actually mostly in Canada. I think I do a couple of things with Lake Erie, but which is on the border as well. So I'm not covering Champ because, again, that's being very ably investigated by other researchers. And there are tons of ghost stories in Canada, which could end up being subject to another book at some point. So those are things that didn't get included here. But believe me, we found plenty of odd things to talk about today.
Well, I have to say, Travis, whenever I come across a new book which is dealing with these subjects, I'm always very impressed when somebody dodges the easy option, really, because as you say in your introduction and as you've mentioned there, there's really covering Sasquatch. You're not really diving into Champ because obviously that's a cross-border phenomenon anyway. You're staying well away from Canada's wonderful history of ghosts and also the Wendigo as well. So essentially, I think it's always very brave when an author avoids the easy wins, really, because when you cover a book diving into Canada's rich history, and as you refer to there, there are so many strange creatures of all kinds of descriptions wandering about the Canadian wilderness, and even obviously in more residential areas as well. It's not just sort of to the northern parts of the country. Canada has more than enough to fill in the gaps in those creatures' absence at this point.
It absolutely does. I mean, if you look at the book on Amazon or whatever, you look at the table of contents, you know, it's unknown animals that are extinct, animals on the land, animals in the sky, animals in the water, you know, they're, and that's just the cryptid section. I found some interesting Fortiana stuff from the miscellaneous section, things like fire spooks, spontaneous fires breaking out in different places. I found some fascinating UFO encounters, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit tonight. There's even reports of merpeople in Canada. And what I found particularly interesting was there were reports of merpeople amongst the native people there.
Mm.
And what fascinated me about that was that almost to a person, all of the accounts of these people that live in the water describe people. And remember, these are indigenous folks that are describing this. Describe these people as being light skin and either red or blonde haired. Now, explain that one. I have no idea, because normally if we see something, we look for things that are similar to us, right? And these beings, whatever they are not similar to the native peoples here at all. They sound very Celtic or Northern European. So I was fascinated by that. But again, as we've said, there's a lot of things that we can cover in Canada.
I think as well, when it comes to the subject of mere people, often people will try and suggest that these are European imports that came across with the immigration from Europe. And like you say, more northerly Europe, because obviously the history of mer people is well established in countries like Scotland and most of the countries in Scandinavia, both of whom were very committed in regards to moving out to Canada in the 18th and 19th century, Travis. And yet, as you say there, the native people's descriptions of these merpeople make them sound European, even though these stories predate European expansion on the level that it became. So that is always a very interesting thing, because if we were to presume that these are just tall tales passed down, well, these people didn't have contact with anybody of a lighter skin and a fairer hair color, because the majority of Native Americans and First Nations people are dark skinned and obviously darker of hair. So that in itself makes it an interesting subject because they are creating something that they don't have any experience of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded, and I talk about this in the fairy section of the book as well, because of course I had to have fairies. It's kind of one of my things, one of my various interests. But in that, I talk about how there were folks in Scotland who were relocated forcibly to the New World. And some of those folks actually worked with the fairy, you know, were said to work with the fairy beings who inhabited their homeland, so that when they moved to the States, or were moved to the States, I should say, they felt that they had lost those contacts until sometime later, when those contacts seemed to renew themselves. So if we follow the animist idea that we live in a vast spiritual ecosystem as well as physical ecosystem, seems like some of the fairy from those areas in Scotland and so forth made that migration. Now, I don't understand, though, how a mer-being could appear to an explorer in, you know, the 1600s and create quite an issue when this individual had a native woman with him. He spotted this creature in one of the lakes in Canada, took up his rifle and was going to shoot it. And his native companion basically wrestled the rifle away from him and told him he was an idiot, you know, that if he had shot at one of them, she referred to them as the gods of the lakes and streams. If he had shot at this thing, it would have been disastrous for him. And she took the rifle and took off. I mean, she wasn't going to hang around and see what happened, because apparently their understanding was that the wrath of these beings was not something you wanted to face. The interesting postscript to that story is that the explorer and his men camped on the shore. I think it was Lake Ontario. No. It was Superior, the lake where the Edmund Fitzgerald sunk, known for its wild storms. And they camped on the shore, and that night, one of those storms blew in, and it blew so hard that they actually had to take up camp in the driving rain and move up away from the shore of the lake in order to keep from being drowned. Coincidence? Maybe. But one of the standouts in mermaid or merman or mer people lore that these beings have an influence over the weather. And sounds to me like somebody ticked off a mermaid.
Very true. And this kind of power over the elements is something that is ingrained in all cultures that believe in people of the waters. Mm-hmm. When I've discussed legends that were brought over from Africa into some of the US states during the 17th and 18th centuries, Travis, there is this connection between the power of water and offending these spirits. And as you say, be it either taking up arms against the residents of a particular body of water or treating that body of water with disrespect, is only usually going to end up one way. And that's never usually good for the landlubber, never mind anybody else.
No. And then, of course, you also have the tie-in with some of the abandoned ship mysteries that we come across, like the Mary Celeste and the Resolve, which are in the book, where a boat is found, a ship is found, it's seaworthy, it's in disarray, but the crew completely disappeared. Now, in my mind, you know, of course, it's always possible that they abandoned ship and then their lifeboat sank or whatever. And they were lost at sea for whatever reason and nobody could find them. But if you've been doing paranormal things for a while, you also, in mysteries and myths, we read stories of vehicles going into clouds and disappearing entirely. So my mind always flips to things like that, where, maybe perhaps this vessel sailed through one of these clouds and came out without its crew. The other thing that occurs to me, though, is, we have these reports of mer people off the coast of Canada. One of the things that is supposed to happen when you, or that can happen, according to the legends, when you aggravate one of these beings is they have the power to basically lure you off the ship to your death. The sirens in Greek mythology on forward. So, I mean, that ties into yet another mystery. We can go on and on.
When you look at the Mary Celeste, it's one of those stories that seems to have been with us probably nearly 150 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a mysterious case. There's a lot about it that doesn't make any sense, primarily because for many people involved in the maritime business, there is this perception sometimes, Travis, that certain ships are cursed, regardless, from inception to disaster, essentially.
Yeah.
It's just a case of it. And the thing about the Mary Celeste is obviously the Mary Celeste was a renamed ship. I think, was it the Amazon originally?
It was originally the Amazon, yeah. And it was purchased under shady circumstances by an American businessman who changed the name in order to avoid some kind of a tax, import or export tax. So the Mary Celeste was a renamed ship, which is one of the primary superstitions of the sea. It's like those are supposed to be bad luck. The boat had a strange fate almost from the beginning. On its maiden voyage, if I recall, the captain came down with pneumonia hours out of harbor. And they had to return, and he eventually died right there in town before a doctor could get there. After that happened, things seemed to settle down for a little bit. You know, the boat was, as I said, acquired under shady circumstances. The name was changed, and almost immediately, this ship put to sea, and the captain waved at another seaman who was captaining the Dei Gratia,
mm-hmm.
that they were leaving the harbor. And several days later, the Dei Gratia found the Mary Celeste adrift with rigging in disarray and nobody aboard. And there have been theories about what happened to the crew, ranging from sea monsters, which I think is a little far-fetched because the ship was in good condition. So unless the sea monster was just hanging around waiting and plucking people off the deck. I mean, always the possibility, I guess, to pirates, which doesn't seem likely because the cargo for the ship was mostly intact. The Smithsonian theorized that there was some kind of a navigational breakdown. But what nobody can explain is what the heck happened to the crew.
Mm.
I mean, they're just gone. They disappear from history at that point in time. And, you know, even if you say, well, there was an navigationer, they went this way, bad things happened, and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like with the case of the Resolven, which is very similar.
Yeah.
The skeptic theory was, oh, well, they encountered icebergs, and the captain didn't have any experience with icebergs, so he abandoned ship. Well, okay. I'm off the coast of Newfoundland. I'm an experienced sea captain. Even if I've never come across them, I have to know I'm going to run into icebergs. So what do you do? Well, you treat them very cautiously and you go around them, right?
Yep.
I mean, this isn't hard.
Yeah.
So the skeptical arguments just don't hold, really. There are obviously attempts to maintain, to strip away any mystery that there might be to these things and just put them down to natural causes. I find the fact that an entire, you know, ship full of people can disappear interesting. Even if, you know, you could prove to me that all of these people got into a lifeboat and they rowed the 50 miles or whatever it was to the Newfoundland shore, and then they all decided that they were going to live in a cave for the rest of their lives and never associate with anybody else, that would still be interesting to me because I'd want to know why.
Yeah.
And we find no evidence that happened.
Hmm.
We find no evidence at all of these people ever reappearing anywhere, any body washing up, anything like that. And while it's possible for things to disappear at sea, just as it's possible for things to disappear in the forest, it's still interesting because we don't know why. We don't know what happened. And that mystery is what keeps us going.
With the Mary Celeste, I think there are several things that elevate it, because obviously the captain's wife and his daughter, I think, were on the ship as well.
Yeah.
And this is one of the heartbreaking aspects of the whole story, is that they'd left their son back in the US. And he waved the family off, and that was the last time he ever saw them.
Right.
And it's very odd because obviously the British get involved in the Mary Celeste case, because when the Dei Gratia recovers it and takes it, I think they take them to Gibraltar to claim the bounty that you would get for a ship that's lost. The British simply tried to accuse them all of murder and said that they killed everybody, and a rusty sword wasn't rust, it was blood, and essentially none of the evidence stacked up. But the British consul decided that they didn't believe these American sailors and their excuse and story that they'd come across the Mary Celeste just bobbing along on its own, and only gave them a fifth of what they should have got. So there's a whole range of strange things. And like you say about the iceberg theory, that makes even less sense that you would have a captain. This guy wasn't inexperienced, Travis. He was a well-known seafaring man. He wasn't just somebody who turned up going, oh, this is my first job. An inexperienced sailor is not going to take his wife and child on a transatlantic crossing with even the most naive wouldn't do that to that. And so for people to suggest that they all got into that little rowing boat because of some icebergs makes you think, well, I'd fancy my chances more on a larger ship than a rowing boat if I was in an iceberg covered part of the ocean.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the iceberg theory was actually put forward for the Resolvin case. But yeah, I'm sure somebody's probably tried to marry Celeste too. It's one of those things that you look at and you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah, I've seen every theory under the sun put forward for the Mary Celeste. As you were saying, sea monsters, UFOs.
Oh yeah,
Atlantis. Pirates, like you say, well, pirates aren't going to kidnap people and leave the cargo because the cargo is probably worth more than the people. So yeah, it's just Arthur Conan Doyle has a lot to answer for because he's the person that made that story famous, and he got quite a lot of it wrong, including the name of the ship. So it's all down to him. It's his fault.
Yeah, it's all his fault. we'll blame our father Conan Doyle.
And as you were saying about Canada, because it's the country with the longest coastline in the world, it seems endemic with strange stories. You know, as we've touched on about mere people, even fairies that were supposed to live around certain areas of water. Canada has such a long history of sea serpent sightings off both east and west coasts, up and down all, you know, in every province in the country. It's synonymous with strange things in the water across all realms of the weird, isn't it?
It is. As I said, you know, we have sea monsters that are sea serpents and sea creatures. We'll call them creatures because they're not always serpents. Creature sightings on the Atlantic coast. We have them on the Pacific coast. And we have them in the lakes all throughout Canada.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking before the show about Ogopogo.
Yay.
And the interesting thing about Ogopogo is that one of the theories that's been put forward for the monster of that lake is that it's actually a creature that lived in the seas off of the Pacific coast and is now known as Caddy. Because somebody decided that they were going to call it the Cadborosaurus because of one of the places where it was seen. Now, you mentioned Carl Stuker and Roy Mackle and several other noted cryptozoologists and members of the British Columbia Cryptozoology, Scientific Cryptozoology Association, have all theorized that critter is actually a relic. I think it's pronounced Zeuglodon.
Yeah.
It's a primitive whale. And, you know, you have people in Lake Okanagan who have come into very, very close range of this creature. Even the people that have been brushed by it. So there's a story in the book about a woman who was swimming off the shore of just offshore on the beach of Okanagan. And this thing actually brushed her leg as it was moving out into the out into the deeper water. And the descriptions of this creature are remarkably cohesive throughout history. You know, it's not so much a serpent as it is a kind of a large, broad creature with flippers, which, you know, sounds a whole lot like the Zeuglodon. If somebody wants to Google that and take a look at the picture, you could see this thing swimming around in somebody's lake somewhere if it did happen to survive from the dinosaur era. And the funny thing about that idea, everybody gets, oh, dinosaurs are extinct. Well, then why do we have a report report from a guy who used to live in Brampton, Ontario, which isn't too far from where I'm sitting right now, of a small pterodactyl type creature flying by his house one day, complete with a diamond flange tail. Okay, maybe he misidentified a bird. But then there's the story from up north where a group of hunters in the 1800s were tracking moose and came across these enormous tracks and eventually encountered a creature that a priest identified as a ceratosaurus, which these guys were like completely taken aback and ended up abandoning the hunt and, you know, running back to the local village because, you know, they weren't equipped for dealing with large flesh-eating dinosaurs. So, and we have a report from a tracker and hunter back during that day of finding a mammoth track.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's all of this, all of these strange encounters with creatures that should be extinct, and makes you wonder if I'm sure you know the BBC show Primeval, right? It's one of my favorite things. I love that show. And you know, this whole business of anomalies open and allowing creatures from the past, or in their case, the future, to come into our time period. You have to wonder, you know, are these beings relics, examples of extinct creatures, or are they actually coming back from the time period that they were existed in? You know, when we start to look at the weirdnesses of time, you know, in quantum physics and so forth, you have to wonder if time isn't more circular and things will just drop down a hole sometimes if you're in our time period.
I think as well, Canada, for me, Travis, I would say it's probably the home of lake monsters, whatever they are.
Oh,
because there seems to be so many across the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
Caddy and Ogopogo are probably the two prime leaders in the field, shall we say, the most famous. But there seems to be most large bodies of water in Canada seem to have a resident monster of some description. Not all of them as you know, the traditional sea serpent lake monster types, because, I mean, one of the things I've always said, and as we said before we started the interview proper, I have to say, for me, on a body of evidence, I think Ogopogo is the most convincing, because as you touched on, when you've got this aspect of the country as well, because there are a lot of Canadians who are, once again, are very comfortable working in the water. A lot of them do it recreationally as well as for business, Travis.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with people who have experience of being out in strange bodies of water, used to the weather, used to the creatures around them. And yet all across the country, people are bumping into Bessie and Caddy and Memphrey. Mm-hmm. And Pokey, you know, there are lake monsters.
Phil Bay Kelly and and I can't remember what the one in Lake Erie is called, but I think that might be Bessie. But
yeah,
I mean, everywhere you go, and I lived on the shore of Lake Erie for 13 years. You know, I never saw a sea monster while I was there, but you know, one of the things that a lot of people don't understand, particularly about the Great Lakes, is just how big they are.
Yeah.
When you look out, Lake Erie is one of the smaller ones, and you know, unless it's an exceptionally clear day, you can't see from one side to the other. It's not really a lake. It's an inland sea. It just happens to be fresh water.
Yeah.
And then when you start to talk about like Lake Superior, Lake Ontario, and some of the other Great Lakes, which are larger and deeper and colder, I don't have much trouble believing just about anything. One of the lakes in Quebec has a monster that they report that's basically a giant catfish. Now, there are large species of catfish, some of which are extant in North America, but nothing that big. If you wanted a catfish that big, you'd have to go to Asia. That's not something, there's no evidence that there's an invasive catfish species living in the lakes of Quebec. And we have to tie all of it then to the fact that there are, again, going back to John Worms and Strange Creatures Seldom Seen, there are numerous reports from native people in Manitoba of giant snakes, which rival the Titanoboa stories that come out of South America, right? These enormous snakes, 30, 40 feet long in some stories. And the commonality there is they all live near water. and are seen near water and tend to, you know, be seen in these swampy, marshy areas around lakes and rivers and so forth. So, you know, if these creatures swim, I have to believe that a substantial portion of, lake monster sightings in Canada come about from these giant snakes swimming around in the water. Because again, you have these people who live on in this land who hunt and trap and fish for survival. They know the land. They know the animals that live on the land, and they know when something doesn't belong. And these things don't belong. There is no species of snake in Canada that's supposed to be, according to herpetologists, the people who study snakes, there's not supposed to be any species of snake over like 4 or 5 feet long, much less 20 feet long. Mm. And yet we have stories of people encountering snakes in the lakes that big enough to bump their boat out of the way and keep swimming without even paying attention to them. So again, we're told over and over that these things can't exist, that Canadian winters would kill them and so forth, or, you know, it's an escaped python that got big or whatever. Having lived through a number of Canadian winters now, I can say pretty effectively that no snake is going to live through this winter. They've got to find snakes that do live here have to hibernate, so these large snakes, whatever they are, either they're otherworldly creatures that are popping over to a much warmer zone, or, they found a place to hibernate, which leads us, to another strange animal topic. We'll talk about that in a minute. But yeah, I mean, so, when you start to talk about these things that live, in the water here, there's all kinds of, if you're interested in lake monsters, read this book, because I go from British Columbia all the way across to Lake Utopia, New Brunswick. Lake Utopia is in New Brunswick. And there are lake monsters reported all across the country, along with all kinds of other weird animals. Well, there are big kangaroo sightings in Canada. And I even have a couple of African lion stories in the book. It's like, where the heck did we get an African lion from?
Well, that made me chuckle when I was reading the book when you were touching on kangaroos. Because also I first became aware of these strange kangaroo sightings in North America through Lauren Coleman's Mysterious America book. And at the moment, there's some wallabies on the run here in the UK, which is one of those. Yeah, we've got quite a few hidden populations of wallabies. And I'm amazed that they're one of those creatures here, Travis, that have been hopping about for nearly 100 years. They all escape from private zoos and collections. From the Isle of Man to the Yorkshire Moors to the South Downs, there are these little populations and pockets. And obviously, as Britain's become a little bit more European in its climate, they've begun to thrive because, I mean, they're hardy creatures anyway, and they're, covered in fur. So they're quite resilient little animals. And now we've got some running about all over the place.
I'm not insinuating that strange paranormal portals opened up in Australia and sucked in the kangaroos to the mountain Canada.
No.
Well, it's interesting. Okay, where did they come from?
Yeah.
Because nobody seems to have any idea. There's not been any escapes from the zoo or any of that kind of stuff. The same way with the lion. I talk about a phenomena that I'm sure you're very familiar with, living in Britain, the whole alien big cat thing.
Yes.
There's a interesting section in the book about a report that was done by the Ontario Department of Natural Resources, or whatever they call it. I don't recall what it's called right off the top of my head, but the people who are in charge of the environment here, where they were trying to ascertain whether cougars had actually, the mountain lion, Puma concolors, I believe, had actually made a comeback in Ontario. And they did this multi-year study, and they concluded that, yes, indeed, there were actually, wild cougars here in Ontario. And as an addendum to this, they sort of nonchalantly mentioned the fact that there were 44 confirmed sightings, confirmed credible sightings of quote-unquote black cougars. Now, according to zoologists, cougars are not melanistic. Mm. They are not black. There is no such thing, according to modern science, as a black cougar. And yet you have all these people in this report that have seen this, and the scientists took them seriously enough to mention it in the appendix to the report.
Yeah.
You know, and of course you have all the Black Panther sightings and things that happen here, including one where you start to wonder if we're not going to start to get Catman stories, because there's this fellow who's going back to his house and this beast chases him from the forest, and as it gets close to him, it gets up on two legs and starts whacking at him with its paws, and he scares it off with an axe. And this happens like two or three times as he's running back to his home. Cats are not bipedal.
No, not at all. And when I was reading that portion of the book, it made me chuckle, Travis, because I've spoken to several researchers in the US and here in the UK. One of the funniest things I ever heard, a forestry worker told David Weatherly, that there couldn't be any panthers in Georgia because they were from Florida, as if cats know where borders are. Because obviously Georgia is next to Florida. So as it, they were working on the presumption that these cougars, panthers, whatever they wanted to label them as, wouldn't come into Georgia because they were only found in Florida. And that, as far as they were concerned, they stopped at the state borders, which is, anybody who knows anything about cats knows that if there's one thing cats don't do, it's follow anybody's rules.
Exactly. I find that hysterical, particularly since the Florida panther, the mountain lion species that is indigenous to Florida, is extremely rare anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So not only is it funny that, the cats are following the borders, but this is a very rare species and now it's appearing in Georgia. How did that happen?
Yeah.
There are a number of, I don't want to get down this rabbit hole too far, but there are a number of state departments throughout the east, on the eastern side of Mississippi, that swear there's no wild population of mountain lions in their state. Pennsylvania is a good example. When there are clearly pictures of and witness sightings of these things all the time.
Yeah.
They were pretty much killed off in the 1800s because they were a threat to livestock, but they have rebounded and made their way back into the eastern part of the United States. Mm-hmm. And that's clear. And you have, Appalachian Mountains, which are perfect, absolutely perfect habitat for these cats. So why would they be so determined to say, no, there's no such thing as a mountain lion in Pennsylvania or wherever?
Mm.
Because maybe then they'd have to protect them.
Well, that is, for a lot of people, that's the key reason, Travis, I think, that there would be some kind of protection that would have to be brought in. And some of these areas are game areas. But when you speak to the majority of people that have these encounters, these are experienced hunters, gamekeepers, people who know the woods, hunt for their livelihoods. These are experienced people. And once again, you have this situation, as we were talking about, some of the responses that officialdom has towards native people when they're talking about some of their experiences. They're just dismissed out of hand by a guy in an office, I'm gonna take the word of a guy that's been out in the woods for 30 years over somebody pushing paper around a desk for 25 years
and you have the same circumstance with, and I don't want to get, again, too far off the tangent, because this book doesn't talk about Sasquatch, but you have the same thing in Canada when you start to talk about Sasquatch reports. You have people who've been out there moose hunting and deer hunting and all kinds of other hunting for their entire lives.
Yep.
They were old enough to hold the gun. And you have some twerp who's telling them, oh, we saw a bear. But they've shot bears. They've probably eaten a bear. I mean, because you can. It's doable from what I understand. I've never eaten a bear, but, I understand that they can be a food source. And just the audacity of some schmuck trying to tell, an experienced hunter that he didn't see what he saw or she didn't see what she saw. I mean, it's one thing to tell somebody that had a quick roadside sighting that, maybe they misidentified something. But it's another thing to tell a hunter who's looking at a creature through his scope.
Yes.
His rifle scope, that he didn't see what he saw. It's always amazing to me that people just have the audacity and the arrogance to tell witnesses, but especially very credible, qualified witnesses, that they didn't see what they saw.
Absolutely.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, strangely, speaking of people misidentifying bears, I was delighted to see in your section on one of my favourite Canadian cryptid mysteries, which are these incredible stories about bear-sized beavers. Now, this is one of those aspects of wildlife that we have fossil records of these. I mean, by all intents and purposes, Travis, the giant beaver passed out 10,000 years ago at the end of the Ice Age, to all intents and purposes. However, I know enough about Canada to know that some parts of it are extremely rugged and desolate and as far away from anybody as you could wish to possibly be and still be in an inhabited country, by all accounts.
Right.
And yet, people go, oh, giant beavers, these are just tall tales from the 19th century.
Nope.
As you refer to in your book, there's a whole raft of these stories, some of which have happened this century.
Mm-hmm. Quite a number, most of which happened this century. Again, I have to, again, raise the banner for John Worms and his book, Strange Creatures Seldom See. If it hadn't been for him, I would never have stumbled across this. You know, he and Carl Schuker had kind of, talked their way into it. The interesting thing is that not only did John Worms collect a number of sightings from indigenous people in Manitoba, he saw the thing himself. Now, it was a brief sighting. You know, there are plenty of people that probably say he misidentified something, and maybe he did. But, you know, again, he spent quite a bit of time wandering around Indian reserves and stuff, which is wilderness area, a lot of it. So I'm inclined to believe that he saw what he saw. He saw something swimming in the river that had a head the size of a football. And there was the massive tail flap and so forth. But going back to the giant snakes for a minute, we were talking about where these critters hibernated. And John Worms got onto the whole giant snake, giant beaver episode while he was exploring why it was that these strange holes were appearing in Canada. These large, smooth-sided, 3-foot diameter hole.
Mm.
And the native people told him, well, you know, the giant snakes live in there. Okay, but how did the hole get there in the first place? Oh, well, the giant beavers dig them. And they're very blasé about it, very matter of fact about it. They're like, the giant beavers. And he's like, giant beavers? Says, oh, yeah, we have these beavers up here that are the size of bears. Now, understand that a beaver is normally somewhere, you know, a big beaver, you know, like a large adult weighs less than 100 pounds.
Mm.
You're not going to mistake this animal for a bear. But you have native people who testified to Worms that they saw beavers that were the size of bears. Mm. They encountered these beavers. In fact, you know, there's a story, one fellow, like he spotted the beaver off in the distance. And again, you know, when you have to feed your family, you do what you got to do. He gets out with a baseball bat. He gets out of the car with a baseball bat and tells his friends, I'm going to go get supper, right? So he realizes how big that beaver is. And he suddenly faced off with a beaver that's the size of a bear. He runs for his life because the thing comes after him. And he barely makes it back to the car. His friends tell him this thing was pursuing him in giant leaps and bounds as he's fleeing for his life away from this giant beaver. Now, beavers don't act that way. Beavers are very shy, very reticent creatures. They don't see people. So, you know, that's a double indication that he was encountering something that wasn't quite your normal beaver, not to mention the size of the thing. There are reports from reserves, what people in the States call reservations, in case I've got some United States folks listening. There are reports from reserves all throughout Manitoba of these giant beavers. There was one report where, there's some indication these guys not only eat the standard beaver diet, but they supplement their diet with fish. There's one story where the couple were watching one of these giant beavers swimming around in a pond or a small lake, and they had been fishing, and all of a sudden the fishing went dead. They could catch nothing, and they saw one of these giant beavers, and the thing would dive under the water and the fish would come shooting out of the lake like, you know, the whole surface of the lake had been electrified by trying to get away from the. So apparently the giant beavers not only, you know, are not only giant, but they're not completely vegetarian. There's a picture in Worm's book. Somebody in Manitoba's actually made a statue of one of these beavers, and he's standing next to it, and it comes up to his shoulder. It's standing up on its back legs, and it comes up to his shoulder. It's so big. A couple of young ladies that were out gathering berries one day saw a couple of these things scurry off of a ledge and into the water from the lakeshore, and they were so large that at first they mistook them for black bears, and then they realized that these things had the broad, flat beaver tails, and they looked more closely, and they were giant beavers. So not only did they look at this thing and say, oh, wait, that's not a bear, they identified it positively by looking at its tail, looking at its head, the way its ears were shaped. You know, it was a beaver. It was a giant beaver. So Worm, you know, got it from the First Nations people that these guys dug these tunnels, and then the big snakes came through and smoothed them out. And that's how you ended up with these long tunnels with these, you know, extremely smooth sides, because giant snakes were lodging in there and hibernating in the winter. So it's all part of a vast cryptid ecosystem, which kind of made me laugh right there. You know, as I was reading it, but you can just imagine, you know, you're walking around in the wilderness in Canada and you encounter a giant beaver, how that would set you back. I mean, it's bad enough seeing something like a Sasquatch where you're like, oh my gosh, that's like a giant monkey or whatever, you know, but a beaver, I mean, who'd have thought of a giant beaver? And that was, I mentioned in the conclusion to the book that there were some stories that I came across that just made my jaw drop. And that was one of them. I had never heard of this before. I was so glad that I stumbled across that book, because it just was a wealth of information.
Yeah. I think, to be honest, as you were mentioning about that chap with the baseball bat that was deciding to get himself some supper, obviously, like you say, because some of these people have reported that beavers have supplanted their diet with a high fish content, which would also explain their larger size, because obviously the bigger something is, the more voracious an appetite it has. And obviously fish are very good and full of plenty of protein for a growing beaver, Travis. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be surprised, absolutely, if they developed a taste for salmon or the like. One would suspect, was the beaver either after him, or did he have a wooden baseball bat? It's, oh, that'll look lovely in my lodge.
Oh, well, yeah. It's entirely possible, but, you know, I mean, if you're talking about a beaver that size, I wouldn't stand around and argue with
it. I want to find out what it had.
You know, even the little ones have very sharp teeth, and, you know, they're quite capable of taking down a tree. So I'm not going to argue with that guy. If he wants my bat, I'll give it to him. I don't have a problem with that. As long as he doesn't decide to take the hand with it, I'm good.
Yeah, well, they've only just started to reintroduce beavers to the UK. And a lot of people have been surprised how successful they've been, because they've started turning up in places they weren't introduced now.
Well, they have, you know, this wonderful dense coat, which is part of the reason why they were hunted to extinction in some places. You have this wonderful dense fur coat that's, you know, that keeps them warm in the wintertime. And, of course, they have that gift for building, you know, constructing these dams and lodges and so forth, which, you know, the other thing that Native people told John Worms was, yeah, you know, we have these big beavers that live here. And, you know, if you find a beaver lodge that's the size of a man's house, then, you know, you found, you know, the beaver lodge for some of these giant beavers. And they're very matter of fact about it. It's like, oh, yeah, we have giant beavers and they build giant houses out more. You just don't mess with them. Leave them alone.
Definitely. I don't think anybody would be wanting to, like you say, stumbling. It's worrying enough, as you say, if you run into something as strange as a Sasquatch. But I think there's something more frightening about stumbling across a creature you know, but it's a gigantic one.
Yeah, it's like the giant snakes we were talking about earlier. Not only is it bizarre that there are these huge snakes in a place like Canada, which is frozen wasteland, because but the people that report these things are giving descriptions of different kinds of snakes so that you have one guy who's telling you, oh, yeah, long, black, blah, 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 kind of snake. And then the next guy will tell you, oh, yeah, it was a 30-foot long garter snake. How do you account for that? I don't even know. Did the garter snakes decide to take up eating beavers for to grow to their gigantic size? I don't know. It's just really incredible to think of, you know, encountering something common like a garter snake, only it's so large it could swallow you. That's scary. That's enough to scare most people.
I think one of the other intriguing points of the book is your section where you're talking about these wolf-type cryptids. And the thing about Canada is it seems to be ticking all the boxes, Travis, when it comes to the to wolf, man-wolf, dog-man, werewolf-type stories. I've always liked these stories that have come out of Canada about the Loup Garou, primarily because out of all these wolf-based monsters that seem to be running amok in wooded areas across North America, the Loup Garou seems to be quite the pleasantest of the family, it would seem.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. The Loup Garou is actually a werewolf, but it is commonly believed to have become a werewolf because of some religious failing. Now, you know, the epicenter of the Loup Garou legend is obviously Quebec. It's French Canada, but the which is a hugely Roman Catholic area of Canada. So, you know, you have the story of this Loup Garou who becomes a werewolf because he's not going to mass, he's not making his confession, or you know, something along that line. The interesting thing is that the Loup Garou is not permanently cursed to its state. The curse only lasts for something like 100 days, and then that person reverts back to being a normal human being again. If you want to break the curse on a Loup Garou, you have to draw blood, release some blood from the Loup Garou, and you have to speak its human name, and that breaks the curse. As long as you and the werewolf keep silent, if either of you says anything about this individual having been a Loup Garou, then a curse reinstates itself, and you end up, poor guy ends up being a werewolf again for a period of time. The interesting thing about the Loup Garou is that while it was known to create havoc amongst the livestock of people, most of these werewolves tried not to attack people. You know, despite the inflated headlines in some newspapers back in the 1700s, 1800s, or whatever, that tried to equate the Loup Garou with the beast of Gévaudan, which is entirely different critter and quite destructive to people. But that was a French thing, not a Canadian French thing. So, you know, the Loup Garou comes across as being a much more approachable werewolf than some of the European Germanic werewolves who were just like, I'm eating everybody and everything. You know, I'm eating livestock, and if you get in my way, I'm going to eat you too. So that's interesting. Probably, though, one of the things that fascinated me in doing the research for this book, there is a critter up north that lives in the place called the Nahanni Valley, which has been nicknamed the Headless Valley for reasons that I'll get to in a minute, called the Wahila. And the description of this thing is that it's basically a giant wolf, a giant white wolf. Now, I think that the Wahila has been maligned, to put it simply. In one of his books, Ivan Sanderson tells a story of I believe he was a mechanic who went hunting in the Nahanni Valley with a native guide. And the native guide went into a copse of brush to flush something out. And he did flush something out. He flushed out a giant white wolf, which approached this mechanic fellow, who opened fire on it with a 12-gauge shotgun that was loaded with bird shot and heavy shot. Had absolutely no effect on this creature, and it just turned and ran off. And when the fellow asked his native handler, you know, about this beast. The guy got really pale and told him, you know, that not a wolf. They live out on the frozen tundra, and they avoid regular wolves, and they scavenge, you know, they scavenge meat and so forth. Now, this thing was huge. You know, it was probably 3.5 or 4 feet high at the shoulder. And so for whatever reason, Sanderson tied the presence of this creature into stories coming out of the valley of prospectors being found without their head. That's the name Headless Valley. So the Wahila got this rap of being this you know, monster wolf that chomped the heads off of people. If you start to research the story, though, you go back to, I think his name is Pierre Bertrand, who wrote a book called The Mysterious North. And he has a whole section of how he talked a pilot in taking him into the Nahanni Valley. At the time that he did this, everybody who he talked to that told him that he was absolutely crazy to do this. But there were these, you know, almost Jules Verne type legends of this, you know, mysterious valley that was, you know, in the far north, that was like this tropical wonderland that had the mysterious people living in it. And all, you know, it was very much like a Jules Verne treasure tale, right? And he wanted to go see what was really there. And the native people and people who had hunted and trapped in that area told him, don't go there. It's dangerous. There are these mysterious men who kill people living there. No mention of a giant wolf creature, right? There are these mysterious men that kill people who live there. Well, Bertrand went anyway, and he wrote this really wonderfully evocative description of the valley and how they got in and how they got out and all this stuff. And nothing terrible happened to him. But people tend to ignore that because Sanderson said, well, Wahila and headless corpses. And they were like, oh, wow, that's exciting. The big wolf is chomping people's heads off. When in reality, the native people in that area said that there were a tribe of wild men, basically, who were killing people. Now, that brings up the whole Sasquatch idea. Like, okay, we know that there are at least some of these creatures that are aggressive. See the Ape Canyon incident. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe a group of Sasquatch decided they just didn't want any black people there. and took care of it their own personal way. Or perhaps there were a tribe of people in that area that, you know, were trying to keep the area to themselves, and they were trying to drive off settlers. There's no telling. But it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the Wahila. But we see this giant wolf thing that appeared in the thing, and we're thinking to ourselves, well, does that thing even exist? I mean, we got the one witness and the native guy telling you something, and that's about all we know. And so we start to look at Linda Gottfried's work, and she describes a creature in the northern part of the state, Wisconsin, that she calls a bear wolf,
yeah,
which bears a remarkable resemblance to the description of the Wahila. And, you know, there were a couple of species of canine forebearers that, you know, are nominated for being the relic species that these guys were. That the Amphitheion seems to be the most likely possible relic creature that could have been the bear wolf and possibly the Wahila. But, you know, she recounts the story of, you know, this couple that, you know, the wife is labor, they're going to the hospital, it's snowing, it's nasty, you know, they're having enough trouble. And this thing comes out of the snow and actually almost tries to bump their car off the road. It's huge, right? They're looking at its shoulder through the car window, right? Mm. It actually comes up and nudges their car, and it gets tangled up and goes flying off in a, you know, big cloud of snow as they drive off in the distance, and they're not going to stop to see what that was. It scared the life out of both of them. I'm surprised she didn't have the baby right there. So we have reports from Wisconsin, with northern U.S., and we have reports from the Nahanni Valley, which is up in far north Canada. Of these creatures, you know, do we have a relic population of, you know, Amphitheion running around out there somewhere? It seems like somebody would have run into one other than people in these cars, if there was like a breeding population. So where are these things coming from?
Mm.
You know, again, you get the whole, is there an anomaly opening and dumping out prehistoric creatures in northern Wisconsin or northern Canada? I couldn't tell you. But that's what keeps us hunting, right? It's the mystery of it.
Absolutely. They may have the same opinion to boulders that the Florida panther has, though, Travis. You know what I mean?
You know
what I mean? Because, you know, we're not talking, you know, Wisconsin is not a million miles away from the Canadian border,
no,
with a grace to respect. No. So,
and it's entirely possible that a creature that large can cover really, you know, a lot of distance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And there's certainly plenty for it to eat along the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because Canada and that northern part of Wisconsin, so there's deer, there's elk, there's moose, there's all kinds of critters up there, you know, large ungulates that would make a tasty snack for something that size.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just in the same way that everybody's always trying to prove, well, you know, Bigfoot could survive in this area because grizzly bears do. It's like, well, yeah, and grizzly bears survive in Canada.
Yeah, I've always thought, because I was aware of the Headless Valley, as it can sometimes be known. I'm of the same opinion of what you were alluding to there, that the decapitation of people would seem to be a more human response to invaders than, because wild animals won't just take the head, they'll eat everything at the end of the day. They're scavengers.
Yeah, they would have eaten at least the good parts of the body. The calorie-rich, dense, fatty portions of the body, and there is no reason for them to bite your head off. They're quite capable, you know, something that size is quite capable of killing you just by chomping down on you and shaking you good.
Yeah,
there's no reason why it would do that. Well, it doesn't make any sense at all.
No, so it makes more sense for it to be some kind of tribe than anything else, I think.
Yeah, and you know, pardon me, you know. I hope your listeners will pardon me for being a little descriptive there. You know, I mean, that's the way predators work.
Yeah.
So that's something that, you know, I just don't see as being plausible.
Mm.
You know, it makes a great story.
Yep.
But I just don't see it as being plausible. I'm perfectly willing to believe that there might be a species of giant relic wolf running around somewhere, but I don't think they're chomping the heads off of people and leaving their bodies laying there.
Yeah, I agree. I think the last aspect of the book that I'd like to touch on before I let you return to the safety of indoors, by the sounds of it, Travis, is I've often been fascinated by the quality of UFO cases from Canada, because I'm often surprised when people seem to just presume that UFOs only fly over the US, which is palpable nonsense for anybody that's even had a cursory look at anything. They've been seen all over the place. But
right. What
I've always found fascinating about Canadian UFOs and some of the work that Chris Rutowski's done over the years is two of my very favorite UFO cases come from Canada, and they happen in the same year. And there's loads that seem to be going on in Canada in the 1960s. So What on earth was happening in Canada in 1967? Because probably the two most famous Canadian cases both happened in 1967.
Yeah, you had Shag Harbor and the Falcon Lake incident. Both happened thousands of miles apart from each other.
Yeah.
Shag Harbor is in Nova Scotia, Falcon Lake is in Manitoba.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of next door to where I am. So they happened incredible distances apart. And during that 1960s period, you had regular Canadian forces and American military forces encounters with UFOs in the sky over places like Newfoundland. It's a Gander Air Force Base sighting that's pretty interesting too. But, you know, I don't know what was happening in 1967. The one thing that occurs to me, though, and a thing that pops up frequently in the UFO section of the book, is the ongoing interest of whatever these things are in the military in general, and particularly in nuclear storage areas and nuclear power stations.
Mm.
There's stories of UFOs in I think the power station was on the shore of Lake Ontario, if I recall. And it was obvious enough that it actually rated a mention in the logbook for that power station. And people that they talked to that were witnesses to this UFO encounter also noted that it looked like this UFO dropped something in the lake and then came back later and was looking for it, which always makes me laugh because it's like, okay, highly advanced technological society and they can't find their own probe. Go figure. But so Shag Harbor and Falcon Lake both are extensively documented, which is what makes them such great cases, because while Falcon Lake only happened to the one person, Stephen Michalak, I'm not sure how he pronounced his name, Michalak.
Yeah, I've heard it pronounced about 20 different times.
Yeah. This fella actually came in close contact with a UFO on the ground at Falcon Lake. He'd been out metal detecting. I think he was out metal detecting. He was an engineer and just happened to have some of his engineering stuff with him that day, which is fortunate for us because he drew us a picture of the UFO and documented size and illustrated things. And he had his special gloves that he used for handling materials and so forth. So this guy was like imminently prepared to run into a UFO if anybody was going to run into one. He noted three craft in the sky. Two of them took off. One of them landed on the lake shore. And he noted that it seemed to be extremely hot, which was interesting. It's like, did the UFO malfunction? They had to set it down and let it cool off for a while. He hid and observed this thing for something like 30 minutes before he went anywhere near it. And he eventually decides, because he hears voices inside, can't identify the language. So he decides that he's going to get closer. There's a hatch open in the side of this craft, which is, your basic flying saucer sort of craft. There's a hatch open inside. He approaches this and he, greets whoever's inside in several different languages. Apparently, he spoke a number of languages. English, Russian, I think German, and something else. I don't remember. As soon as he starts speaking, though, this hatch closes. And he says that it's as though there were no hole there. There were no seams. There was nothing. It's just like the hatch replaced that segment and it was smooth and there was no seam there. And the vehicle rose in the air and turned, and it's kind of like he got caught in the exhaust, set his clothes on fire and knocked him to the ground as it took off. And, the Lorenzans, who were people who documented the case extensively, noted that even several years later, the burn scars were still evident.
Yeah.
He packed himself up and hiked himself out of Falcon Lake. If I recall, he encountered an RCMP officer or called the RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who handle law enforcement in, non-city areas, any federal land, that kind of thing here in Canada. Had the presence of mind to hang on to his clothing that had been burned. He tried to touch the side of this thing with his special gloves, and it sort of melted and split off the surface of the saucer thing. He hung on to those two. He'd actually, for some reason, was carrying welding glasses, which is what he was looking at, using to look into the vehicle. Like I said, it seemed like he was awfully well prepared. But he ended up in hospital for a period of time. He lost an extensive amount of weight afterwards. I showed signs of what looked kind of like radioactive sickness or radioactive poison. And it only recovered slowly thereafter. He was sick for some time after that. So and all of this, they have medical records. They have, pictures of the burns at the time. He had second and third degree burns from this experience, whatever it was. So again, a very, very extensively documented UFO sighting that has people who tried to explain it scratching their heads because what did he run into? Some people note that a Canadian company called Avro was actually trying to build a round aircraft sometime before that in the 1950s, I believe. The program shut down supposedly because the round aircraft is not stable in the air. But we know governments like to take projects underground. You know, we have all that Area 51 stuff that happened. So I imagine that the Canadians who had actually built a landing pad for flying saucers at one point might have taken that project underground, and who knows, they might have been more successful than we knew. Possible that Michalik encountered one of these craft that was being test flown and had had some malfunction. We just don't know. I'm always hesitant about the whole extraterrestrial hypothesis thing, mostly because I think there's something far weirder going on there. But even if we are looking at that particular theory, we don't know what happened that day. Why did this vehicle land where it was? Why did it seem like it was so intensely overheated at the time? You know, we've seen reports of saucers hovering over lakes and dropping hoses into them and sucking water up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why they couldn't do that in this particular scenario. We've also seen the scenario like Sag Harbor where the vehicle disappeared into the water.
Yeah.
If you really needed to cool off your flying saucer, why not take a dive, you know? So we don't really know. We don't know what Stephen Michalik encountered that day, but it is one of the great mysteries of ufology, and one in a case that I think should get a whole lot more attention than it does.
It's also got one of the worst skeptical explanations I've ever come across, which was that some people claimed that he was drunk and fell on a barbecue, and that's why he got burned.
Okay. Yeah. In pinball flies.
Yeah, so I wasn't aware they made disposable barbecues in 1967, mm-hmm. Travis, but maybe the Canadians were ahead of the world in that field as well.
Yeah,
flying circles.
Canadians are known for their inventiveness, so that's entirely possible. And that's how they managed to submerge a whole UFO and hide it, which is what happened in Sag Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Again, another extensively documented case, because you had the RCMP and local police respond. You had boat captains and people who went out to do search and rescue for this particular craft. The Rescue Coordination Center in Halifax was involved. So there were tons and tons of resources thrown at this, because the initial report was that an aircraft had crashed in Sag Harbor.
Mm.
So they thought they had lost a plane. It's going to back up a little bit. You have a group of lights that are seen in the sky. I believe there was an airliner that encountered these things. There was a report from a boat captain that he had seen a formation of lights go overhead. Things really picked up, though, when one of these vehicles, whatever it is, actually settled on the surface of Sag Harbor, which is in Nova Scotia. And as witnesses, were phoning the local constabulary to, respond to, rescue resources, they watched as this thing sank below the surface. The local RCMP detachment arrived. They got the Coast Guard, Canadian Coast Guard, involved. As well as private boats that all went out to where this vehicle, whatever it was, sank.
Mm.
There was a sheen on the water, and according to Joshua Cutchin, there was a very distinctive smell. And people who touched the sheen, who were brave enough to do that, found that it was some sort of an oily substance that was floating on the surface of the water.
Yep.
So the Coast Guard responded. There were inquiries made with the rescue center, as I said, and they verified after some time that no aircraft was missing from Canadian skies, at which point, of course, we're dealing with an unidentified craft. The military became involved and sent divers. Nothing was recovered, which is where the story would pretty much end if it weren't for testimony given to a reporter, and I cannot think of his name now, Chris somebody, and it wasn't Rutkowski, it was somebody else. The fellow who wrote the book about Sag Harbor, basically. There was testimony given to this individual that the object, once it sank, started to move underwater, and actually ended up in a location off the coast of a U.S. military facility, which was, ostensibly being used for tracking submarines.
Mm.
And at that point, the story kind of fades off of, into obscurity because nobody knows what happened. It was crap. It wasn't recovered as far as we know. And we don't know why it was so interested in that U.S. military base. One wonders if there were nuclear weapons there, given the UFO's propensity for showing up around these things. So, again, another situation where extensive documentation from multiple government agencies that were involved in the initial contact, the search and rescue, so forth, that really makes you wonder, what was it that actually went down off the coast of Shag Harbor?
Yep. I've seen people dismiss Shag Harbor. The official line, I believe, was that people had seen a meteor, which is fine. But that doesn't explain the people that saw lights moving under the harbor, floating about all over the place. And the other fact, as you say, Travis, this was seen from in the air, at sea and on land. You had multiple witnesses all in different parts of the area who all saw this thing come down. So,
and if it had been a meteor, it would have been recovered.
Yep.
Or they would have at least found it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you had professional Navy search and rescue divers down there looking for this thing. They would have found it.
Yeah.
Or some indication that it had been there. But there was nothing. They found nothing.
Yeah. Yep. And just left us with 55 years worth of mystery. Mm-hmm. Again.
So, but it's a fascinating case. And then there are more in the book. As I said, there's the Gander incident out of Newfoundland. There's an excellent, excellent story of a giant mothership type UFO over a Montreal hotel.
Yeah.
There's like I said, there's the UFO that was haunting the area of the nuclear power plant, and there's a multiple witness sighting up in Northwest Territory.
Mm-hmm.
Again, of another massive ship flying over lake and some small towns up in that area. Again, extensive documentation from the UFO investigators who investigated. There were so many witnesses that had to give them code names and numbers because this thing basically flew a swath over that entire region. And, they had reports from a lake, and they had reports from a village, and they had reports from a hotel, and they had reports from another village. As it went overhead. And interestingly, that same area had another UFO sighting not too long after that. So we wonder why the UFOs are cruising that area, because it's fairly desolate as far as people go. Not a lot of people. There's plenty of wildlife stuff, but not a lot of people.
Yeah. It's probably just swamp gas, Thomas.
Yeah, it was swamp gas.
Oh, well, it's a fabulous book because I love varied contents when it comes to a collection like this. And there's something for everybody, as we've touched on quite a lot of it. And I also like the fact that you've left the scariest part of the book, in my opinion, for the last chapter, which is the miscellaneous one. But we'll not spoil that. But you've got strange things falling from the sky, people disappearing.
Oh.
A very famous case about a chap who vanished after claiming he was going to meet his alien buddies and all kinds of stuff. So that's probably a chapter to read in the day.
Screwed by lightning.
Yes. So terrifying anybody that's reading that chapter in bed. So I suggest, yes, that's afternoon reading, that particular portion of the book.
unless you are the stout heart or these people light on next to you, but.
All stupid in my case, but there you have it. So Travis, thank you as always. Where can everybody get a copy of the book and keep up to date with your work going forwards, my friend?
As always, the book is available on Amazon, both as a Kindle and paperback. And as far as social media goes, I'm available on Facebook, Twitter, and that Instagram thing. Facebook, you'll find me under Will Watson if you search for Will Watson. Twitter is at WTWatson2. And Instagram is at Kurunir, Kurunir 60. So, I'm always happy to hear from people who've read the book, who have questions about the book. I've even had a few people contact me with witness testimony. And of course, I'm always glad to hear about those things. I hope your readers enjoy the book, or your listeners, I guess, read and enjoy the book. As we said, there's something for everybody in this one as well.
Brilliant. Well, thank you as always. It's always a pleasure for you to scare the bejesus out of me, Travis, with some of these terrifying tales of varying kinds. And I thank you again. Thank you again, as always, for your... I thank you again, as always, for your time, your conversation and your company. And I wish you the best of luck. Speak soon.
Thanks very much, Paul. I appreciate your time. Take care.